Welcome back to Secrets of Statecraft. I'm Andrew Roberts, and my guest today is Conrad Black, Lord Black of Cross Harbour, the Canadian businessman who's an historian and former media mogul.
Conrad, you've written The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, and Volume 1 covers from antiquity to the Caesars, ending in 14 AD with the death of Emperor Augustus. It really is an extraordinary achievement. It's over 1,000 pages long. None of them are boring. It's an extraordinary page-turner, especially the Peloponnesian Wars, Alexander the Great, and Rome. What are you trying to achieve with this gigantic undertaking?
A couple of things. On a straight personal level, Andrew, while I feel pretty much the same as I did 30 years ago, I'm getting older and I want a magnum opus. And I thought this was an ambitious objective, but an attainable one. And if it was going to happen, it has to happen now, given my age, because it is, as you know better than almost anybody, a lot of work to write books like this. Secondly, though, in a broader sense, I felt that it was possible to present the, broadly speaking, political history of the world, by which I mean how people have been organized from the most primitive, authenticatable times, if I may use the word, reliable history as far back as we can get it, of how people were organized and how organized groups and jurisdictions communicated with each other, and the evolution of that. And it could be done in manageable length, considerable length, manageable length, three volumes, big volumes, but not the 30 volumes of the kind that are on the shelves behind me here, which is what people would think, you know, the Cambridge and Oxford histories and so on. And also, I know there's this debate about the great man theory of history and so on, but that's not what this is. But people make history. If there weren't people, there would be no history and nobody would read it or write it. So it is a history of what people do. Mediocre people, great people, terrible people, evil people, and so forth. Although all of us are all of that at different times, I suppose, but in general. And so the only way to make it interesting was to focus on the personalities who made the history. So that's my plan here, to get it into three big volumes. It's distinct chapters. The chapters have breakers in them, a very good index, and you can get anything you want in the political and strategic history of the world at the end of it, just by looking at the index. And if you want to go further into it, obviously you can do that, but at least I give everyone an entree to it.
You certainly do. And the entree from earliest times considers Mesopotamia, the dawn of civilization, Moses, Egypt and the pharaohs, Babylonia, Assyria, India and China. You go on to the Persian Empire and the Golden Age of Greece. But the question that is going to be asked by readers is, do we have anything to learn from these people of 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 years ago? Considering that they thought so differently from the way that we think, their religious views were obviously completely different. You end this this book, of course, just before Christianity sort of emerges onto the scene. But what have we got to learn from the ancient world, from people who, as I say, have different mindsets from us, or do they?
I don't think human nature changes much, but human experience does make our species more sophisticated in some ways. I think it is not so much what we have to learn in what they did, but in some of their traits that still exist, and in the warnings that they gave to avoid certain things. I think the lesson is that a policy of constant war making is a bad policy. And unless you can, as the Romans did, devise a pretext to justify aggression, and the Romans at times became rather ingenious and indeed casuistical in doing that. But unless you can do that, and unless once you have actually committed aggression, you do so to your advantage and persuade those whom you now govern that it was a good thing for them that you're governing them, you shouldn't do it. And the Romans were good at that. As you know, they always lowered taxes. They always increased security for everybody, diminished crime and brigandage and so on. And this was a technique emulated by the British, and to a slight degree, I'm an example of it. They took the more worthy and supportive people in these places that they occupied and elevated them in the Roman structure and put them in the Senate and things. And, you know, like putting Lord Beaverbrook in the House of Lords, that kind of thing. And so you can see these techniques. The other thing I'd mention is that without getting into the subject of religion itself, it should be noted that from the very first and throughout, people always had a preoccupation with what there was that was not visible in the cosmos, a supernatural intelligence of some sort, or some celestial authority that could be propitiated in some way. Now, some of the methods engaged in for this were peculiar and, in modern terms, unacceptable. But that area is in the human psychology, and it hasn't been banished. Now, in those days, there was very little outright atheism, unlike the present time. But that instinct to think that there is something more than we see is not going away. And we have to be careful that it's not occupied by charlatans, and particularly evil charlatans like the pagan festivals of the Nazis and the Stalin communists.
You mentioned earlier the concept of the great man theory of history, or the great man and woman theory of history, as it's called, although obviously for obvious reasons there are many more great men in this. But actually, no, you're very... The Olympia comes out. You call her a careening hellcat.
Yes.
And eminently consolable when her husband Philip of Macedon died, and an orgiastic snake worshipper. She sounds an extraordinary figure from your...
She was ultimately stoned to death by her victims.
Absolutely. But the mother of Alexander the Great. So it's not just the great men of history. It's also
Cleopatra is a great star. In
of course.
Book.
Yeah, she certainly is. But the concept of great men and women has been under enormous ideological attack, hasn't it, from the, well, in a sense, from the Whigs, but also certainly from the Marxists and all determinists who like to see what T.S. Eliot called the impersonal forces of history being much more important than the individual. Whereas this is a fabulous, written in the old manner, comprehensive rejection of that concept, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I it's not for me to attach the flattering adjectives you did, but I think it attempts to be that. In many places, natural phenomena like earthquakes and floods and fires and so on did play a role in history. And obviously, you know, the volcanic eruption, Mount Vesuvius, and the fire in which Nero was wrongfully accused of fiddling. He was actually quite useful at the time. These things are there, but I don't think that what Eliot described as the impersonal forces existed other than to the extent that people devised them or were swayed by them. So what I'm emphasizing is what people do and where they are influenced by some new perspective or something. I certainly emphasize that. We had obviously very different types of thinking in Periclean Athens than we had in Persia at that time, and that highly motivated the Athenians.
Including, obviously, philosophy. You write of the effect that Aristotle had on Alexander. Could you tell us a bit more about the effect of philosophy on politics in the ancient world? How important genuinely was it?
Well, it varied. You know, you had some completely unalloyed scoundrels like Agathocles, even Alcibiades, who was himself, I believe, also a student of Socrates. And I don't think philosophy counted for anything with them, but it did have an impact, broadly speaking, on Alexander. Julius Caesar, who was nominated to the post of Pontifex Maximus at the age of 14 by his uncle, General Gaius Marius, but it wasn't proceeded with, but he did ultimately gain election to that office, did have distinct religious views, and they emphasized, I mean, they were convenient views for a Roman leader to hold, but they did help inform and animate his actions. I think it varies. You get scoundrels who are just out for the main chance, but you get much more thoughtful people, and Pericles is, of course, a particularly prominent example of that.
Yeah, that as I say, the Peloponnesian Wars period is a real page turner in the book. You mentioned Julius Caesar, and you equate him along with Napoleon and Genghis Khan as being a towering and galvanizing historical personality alongside Alexander the Great. And I'd just like to ask a bit about Alexander the Great, because as you point out, he never had more than 50,000 men, and yet he managed to march from the Danube to the Indus without a setback, without a serious setback anyway. How did he do it?
He saw, and in this, I think he benefited from the insight of his father. He saw that the Persian Empire was vulnerable. It had no loyalty from the populations it had occupied, so it could be rolled back relatively easily. Secondly, he saw himself, with reason, as not only a conqueror, but a civilizer who brought with him the Hellenic culture and civilization, which did attract and impress the elites in the various places he went to, all the way to Bactria, which is now Afghanistan, and then to the gates and through the gates of India. He of course was extremely successful militarily, and so he had the system of scattering the armies in front of him, and then working with local officials, but with his own nominees at the head of the local administration, satrapies, but he gave them better government. He gave the elites exposure to Greek culture. He lowered taxes, made the authority of the state less capricious and oppressive, and all these people who were accustomed to being ruled by the Persians, to whom they owed no loyalty, said, "Well, look, this fellow's much better, and he's a great leader." I mean, Darius fled; he was a coward, and this man's a hero, riding at the head of his troops with that very visible helmet he had.
And he went and slept with all of Darius's daughters and Darius's wife. Look, historians are divided about whether Alexander, who you rightly say he's a conqueror and a civilizer, but also an explorer. Point out that how much of an explorer he is. But historians are divided about whether he originally intended to conquer Persia, or whether or not it was just something that happened as a result of his victory after victory. Where do you stand on that?
I think he definitely intended to conquer Persia, because I believe that was his father's ambition also. And he whether he actually took Persia itself or not, that may have been a matter to be determined, but he thought he could take all the Persian conquests, which is all present-day Turkey, for example, for Macedonia, beyond that, I think into Egypt and then along to India. I think that he was just seeing how far he could go, and he He would have gone farther, but his soldiers said, look here, we've been away for 10 years. We have to go back.
Yeah. He became more, would you agree, became more vicious as he went along? I mean, is there an element of megalomania that sets in there towards the...
I think not so much vicious, but starting to drink his own bathwater about being a god, you know. I mean, demanding that people prostrate themselves completely. I mean, this is quite unnecessary, you know. I mean, in their presence, you know, they lie down flat on their faces on the floor in front of it until he told them to get up. I mean, there was, I believe that was the point at which Aristotle thought he'd taken leave of the senses to some degree.
And you do point out that there are people in history, and you mention Cimon and Richelieu and Bismarck, who knew when to stop. Is that an absolutely essential feature of statesmanship, leadership?
I think for a great power, yes. Obviously, for the the leader of Paraguay or Liberia, it doesn't become a problem. But when you're the greatest power in the world, or one of them, if you don't know where to stop, you finally get everybody else determined to bring you down. And that, you and I are both admirers of Napoleon, and he's by no means solely to blame for the fact that he was ultimately not successful. But I think he did not have that same instinct of where it was dangerous to go further, or at least go further without stopping. I mean, I think if you do it in increments, I mean, we've often in conversation with ourselves speculated about Hitler, you know, if he, instead of always wearing a uniform and attacking the Jews and terrorizing his neighbors, he had masqueraded as a civilized German gentleman and had, you know, a few years of peace between doing things, he could have proceeded farther than he did.
Well, especially as obviously if he had another 5 years or so, the nuclear bomb might have been in play, and that would have been horrific, as you for obvious reasons. You spend a lot of time in this book using analogies, historical analogies. You equate Alexander the Great's victory with Napoleon at Ulm, Themistocles and Marshal Soult at one point, the Battle of Granicus with the HMS, the sinking of HMS Hood. You equate Tiberius Gracchus with Warren Hastings, Clive of India. These are really thought-provoking. Hamilcar at one point you equate to Anwar Sadat. These are very thought-provoking analogies.
That caused the most comment is Pericles and Gorbachev.
Really? Yes, I imagine it. Yes, I imagine it would. I imagine it would. But I think, by the way, you're in the way Paul Raher and others are, and Victor Davis Hanson have been writing recently about Pericles. I think you're probably in the mainstream there rather than an outlier nowadays. Yeah, but what I wanted to ask was, this is history on the big stage. This is very much the comprehensive style of writing history. It's sadly considered by a lot of people to be old-fashioned, because history today, especially in the academy, is about siloing. It's about writing about smaller and smaller things, less and less important things in many ways, but also things that are in tight chronologically. And you've just, Rich, literally just sort of thrown all that away and gone back to the old school of big comprehensive history. And I think you're, of course, to be hugely admired for that. But have you got a sense of where the next break is going to be? Are you going to take it up to the Renaissance, or are you going to go further than that at the end of volume two?
That's a timely question. I am three quarters of the way through volume two, and I expect it to get to just before the American Revolution.
Really, as late as that? How interesting.
Well, right now, I just finished with Queen Elizabeth and Henry IV, and I'm about to start on on, you know, Louis XIII is the king, but his mother's the regent. And I'm about to get to Richelieu.
I hope Elizabeth I comes out well. She's
very well. One of the greatest statesmen in European history.
Good, good. That's a big relief, Conrad.
and I believe those are the words in which I end the section on her. Britain's greatest monarch and one of the greatest statesmen in the history of Europe.
You mentioned that, or at least you say that the litmus test of a constitution is how well it works under uninspiring leadership. Which constitutions would you hail in that regard?
Well, the American is the most prominent in every respect, and without being gratuitous, the current administration is proving that point. I mean, the country is surviving from day to day, but it is an administration that's not successful in most policy areas.
They were geniuses, weren't they, the founders?
They were. My theory, by the way, when I get to it, which will be in Volume 3, is that the quality of American leadership in the latter stages of World War II was of approximately equal standard with Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, MacArthur, Nimitz, and General Marshall.
You also say, let's go back to Rome for a moment. I agree with you hugely on American leadership in the Second World War. It's the statesmanship was truly extraordinary, especially the Germany First policy, of course. You say that Rome had a subtlety of government that eluded the Persians or the Greeks, more permanent than Alexander's brilliant but evanescent vision of Hellenization and Greco-Persian integration. But you also say that Philo-Hellenism, I'm assuming you're thinking about sort of Lord Byron and Gladstone and 19th century Philo-Hellenism, is over
Macaulay.
And Macaulay and so on, is over romanticized. So what did Rome have that that the Persians and the Greeks didn't?
Better justice system. Opposite the Greeks, the ability to rise above the city-state. I mean, that was what Rome was. I compare it to Fresno, California, the nearest city to Victor Davis Hanson, your colleague there in California. Pardon me, I'm just getting over a cold. I apologize for my slightly hoarse voice.
Get well soon.
Rome expanded carefully. It only took what it could digest, and it pursued that policy steadily for really 400 years from its founding until the First Punic War. And then that was the first real test of strength outside Italy. But it continued that policy right up to its summit of its influence, the sort of the two peaks of Marcus Aurelius and then Constantine, and even if you want a third peak with Theodosius, but that book, of course, doesn't get to those ones. But the unlike Persia, it only took what it could digest, and in stages over many, many years. And unlike the Greeks, they were able by a different application of the same method to exceed the boundaries of the city-state. I mean, to me, as a reader of the history of ancient Greece, it is frustrating that when Athens finally had the moral authority and the power to be clearly the leading state in Greece, it turned its confederation into an attempt simply to treat all of the other states in the confederation as colonies.
We're talking about the Delian League here, turning the Delian League into an Athenian empire. And that was the key mistake, as far as you're concerned, because they
overtaxed them, and finally they said, "Look, you know, we're not getting our money's worth." I mean, they really did something like what the Americans finally did and said, "Look, we're not paying these taxes; we're not getting value for money."
You've mentioned taxes now three or four times. It's obviously an important theme throughout history. The level of taxation is something that in any political history of the world is of course going to be important. But for you, obviously, it's an absolutely central part of the thesis.
Well, we have I have two answers. I personally find it a somewhat annoying subject, but speaking as a historian,
rather than as a taxpayer.
Yeah, speaking as a historian, I think it's clear that people do respond negatively to oppressive and confiscatory taxation. I mean, you can do it to individuals and persecute individuals, and of course that's often been done. But if you overtax an entire population, eventually it rises up. I mean, I think the case could be made that was probably the greatest single cause of the French Revolution.
You state
excessive and unfair taxation. Yeah.
You state that military conquest, and you said it earlier in this talk, that military conquest is rarely durable. I mean, obviously, there are very few things that are rarely durable, especially from the ancient world. We've got the pyramids and the Parthenon and the Roman Forum, but not that much else, apart from, I suppose, in areas of philosophy and so on. Why is military conquest rarely durable? Is it because it tends to be followed by high taxation? What's the problem with it?
No, I think because I suppose I should have stated that differently. You've caught me in a way here. I think it's durable when it is responding to military force that is not durable. So I think the military force of the Western Allies in World War II, which no one has chronicled better than you have, is durable because it was a response to an illegitimate use of military force that proved not to be durable. But I think the answer is, and I should have phrased it slightly differently, aggressive military force is not durable because ultimately it is repulsed.
Is there another thing you say that heads of state tend to believe what they want to? Is a problem that goes throughout history, maybe into your volumes 2 and 3, that people surround themselves with yes men, that part of leadership, part of being a great statesman is to have the occasional no man who will take issue with you, a kind of Alan Brooke position with Churchill and so on. Is this something you've seen throughout history?
I think that there are those, of course, who will not tolerate, those leaders will not tolerate any difference with their own opinion, whatever the subject. Then there are those who are prepared to listen to it but won't pay any attention to it. And I think at times Napoleon, whom we both admire, was in that category. I mean, General Rapp, for example, who was not a particularly senior person, told him that when Napoleon said, "How far is Moscow from Smolensk?" He said, "Too far," and he's meaning don't go there. And he didn't listen to it. And then there are those who listen carefully to it. And
Berthier
biographies, Mr. Churchill was very good at that. I think he had a lot of advice that he didn't agree with, but he always listened to it. Unless it was nonsense.
Yes, well, of course, no, exactly. Pericles versus Cymon, Gladstone versus Disraeli, Pitt versus Charles James Fox, Jefferson versus Hamilton, you present them all together as arguing that in order to be a truly great man, you really do need pretty good opponents as well. It's that you're kept on your game, essentially, at the top of your game, through having people against you who test you. Is that a fair assumption from what this volume says?
Absolutely yes. If you are working in a stable political system, so in, for example, in the British system or even the Athenian system, I think that it was necessary. A man like Napoleon, who achieved supreme power in revolutionary circumstances, he wasn't operating in a system that provided a loyal opposition. What I really, pardon me, meant was a loyal opposition where other people, qualified, sensible, accomplished people, will say, "Look here, there's another way to do this, or we shouldn't do this." But they're doing it, no doubt, partly in their own interest, but in the overall interest of the jurisdiction in which they serve. But where you are an autocrat, having achieved power by a coup or a revolution, and there is no institutionalized opposition, it becomes more complicated and difficult. Then you have to have the kind of confidence and breadth of vision to have some naysayers in your entourage just to get the other side. And very few people do that, but some do.
This book's very...
You see, the technique's different. I would take a man like Bismarck. I don't think he listened to opposition much, but he knew he had to please the emperor, although ultimately he failed to do it. But that was an emperor. It was impossible to please. Richelieu spoke to you know, the gray eminence, Father du Tremblay, and listened very carefully to his advice. So, I mean, I think people simply don't listen to anybody and bash ahead are going to get into real trouble before too long.
One of the great things about this book is it's full of what my friends call Conradisms. It's a very funny, there are some very,
I hope that's
a of course it is, of course it's a compliment, because it's a very funny book. There are moments that that are laugh out loud funny. The execution of Bezos, for example, and when you say that his not over grieving widow sent his head to Alexander the Great. Not over grieving widow is a classic, what, as I say, my friends call a Conradism. And it's got and it's full of that. Did you enjoy writing this book? Was it fun to do?
One in that category that really I really found astounding was, and I forget who it was, but in ancient Mesopotamia, somebody impaled an opponent, had him stabbed a number of times superfluously, skinned, put in the skin of an ass, a mule, decapitated. His head stuck in a tree, taken down. He publicly urinated on his skull.
And I remember this bit.
And then put it on display.
And I think you have a phrase for that as well, don't you? I seem to remember.
This is carrying animosity to astounding extremes.
And you end the book with this concept of Christianity, a new religious concept. How unusual was it? How new was it? What's how different was it from all of the other kind of religions that that you write about in this book?
Well, it of course had a similarity to Judaism, from which it was in large measure derived, as we all know. But as a monotheism, it was radically different, and it was radically different. It's too obvious to say this, Andrew, to all your viewers would know it as well as we do, but where it was alleged and believed that the one God had one son whom he sent to the earth, who attempted to reason with people and was brutally murdered for his trouble, let us leave aside for the moment the question of how much one believes of the claims of Christian believers.
Well, you're a Roman Catholic. Those... You're a believing Roman Catholic, aren't you, Conrad? So, you wouldn't guess that necessarily from this book, but nonetheless, or I suspect the next volume.
In the words of the late Cardinal Hume, I believe enough of it to get by and get me to paradise. But I'm addressing this comment to those who don't, who think it's rubbish. That's not the point. No serious person disputes that Christ exists, that the apostles wrote what they wrote, and that a great many people believe that he was the Son of God. This is an infinitely more powerful message, the Son of God crucified by men, than anything that could be conveyed by a religion based on a God for every function of nature and that sort of thing. God of victory, a God of the sun, a God of the moon and all that. I mean, and in ancient Mesopotamia, you could proceed 20 miles to a so-called city, a town of 500, with an entirely different set of gods. I mean, this was civilization took a quantum leap in its religious views, its ecclesiastical concept, when it moved to one god for everybody.
Now, there's a question that I always ask all my guests. What history book or biography are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've just finished Anthony Beaver's Russia, Revolution and Civil War, written with his usual rigor. Excellent book,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's a very fine book, isn't it?
And I'm just starting a book your viewers would not be familiar with, but about a late friend of mine, John Turner, the former Prime Minister of Canada, a friend of mine who married a relative of mine. But he was more prominent as Pierre Trudeau's justice minister and finance minister, and also written by a friend of mine who's a television news personality in this country. But both excellent books in their way.
And what's your favorite what if?
Could I give a positive and a negative what if?
Of course.
A nightmare what if? Okay, my nightmare what if is that if Hitler, after the overthrow of the Yugoslav government and the ill-starred Italian invasion of Greece, had postponed the invasion of Russia, and when the Japanese foreign minister, Matsushita, I think his name was, educated in Portland, Oregon, by the way, spoke perfect English, disapproved of anti-Semitism, when he visited Hitler in I think March of 1941, if Hitler had laid out a plan whereby the main German military effort would be in North Africa to take the Suez and the oil fields, and that then Japan could be supplied oil from that source and not from the United States, which was providing 85% of it and which Roosevelt had cut off. So that Japan should not have anything to do with aggression with America, and had postponed the invasion of Russia for a year, and then for Japan to attack in the east so that those forces Stalin had there could not be withdrawn to defend Leningrad and Moscow, he might have ended up with the Japanese in control of the entire Eurasian landmass. That's my nightmare.
So basically the Japanese get Siberia and everything up to
Manchuria,
to the Urals.
A free ticket to take what they want in China, India, and other
countries. Hitler gets the Urals.
But not bother the Americans.
And the Americans don't come into the war, and the Urals to Brest essentially is dominated by Nazi Germany. Yeah, that's a believable and completely nerve-wracking what if. What's your happier what if?
My happy one is that if a man again, yours biographer, if George III and his ministers had managed to work things out with the Americans, so that there was a cooperative arrangement and they'd managed to keep some system going where they worked closely together. By the middle of the 19th century, the Anglo-American empire, if you will, would have been a force of incomparable strength. And at the time of World War I, you would have had a mighty America, all of the British Empire, one government, one parliament, one monarch. Most of the MPs would be Americans, but that's not the point. That'd be an English-speaking government benignly governing South Asia, Australasia, North America, the Caribbean, the United Kingdom, and half of Africa. Even the German emperor would never have challenged such a thing.
Yeah, so you wouldn't have had the First World War, and therefore not Nazism, communism, and the Holocaust.
Precisely.
Can I give you an ancient history one? What if Alexander, instead of dying at the age of 33, had lived to the age of 73 or 63? What could he have done with those extra 30 years of life?
Yes, I think the Hellenization plan and the commingling of Persian and Greek government. I mean, he basically regarded himself as Greek rather than Macedonian. And that he was like the Austrian Hitler being a German, the Corsican Napoleon being a Frenchman, and the Georgian Stalin being a Russian. But sometimes people from neighboring communities know that community better than the people in the community. And Alexander the Hamilton was a West Indian, after all. But I think then you would have had that taking hold. The Hellenization would have been much more durable. And you would have had some expansion into India, better, certainly a better and closer rapport with India. And one assumes that if he'd lived on 40 years, he would have turned his attention to the West. And there was really nothing to stop him from getting something close to the early Roman Empire in place. You know, I mean, there was no force on the littoral of the Mediterranean that could stop him. Now, what he would have made once he got to the Tenebrous forests of Germany, I think even he would have found that a bit of a challenge. But it would have been a unification of really probably all the known world and more. Except I don't see how he could have got hold of China. I think he might have. I mean, I just think that's too different a culture and too many people. But it would have been a marvelous and very, as long as he was there, a very benign empire. Of course, the horror was dying when he did. What happened was all that period when he would have been 73 was filled with these horrible wars between his subalterns, which included the massacre of every member of Alexander's family, not just his mother, his wife, and his infant child. It was a horrible thing.
Conrad Black, author of The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. Thank you very much indeed for coming on my podcast. You might be Roman Catholic just enough to get you to paradise, but you've already written a book that's going to get you to historians' paradise.
In that case, I look forward to seeing you there, Andrew.
Thanks, Conrad.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Conrad. Join me on the next Secrets of Statecraft, where my guest will be Toby Young, journalist and director of the Free Speech Union.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution, where we generate and promote ideas advancing freedom. For more information about our work, to hear more of our podcasts, or view our video content, please visit hoover.org.